Welcome back to the Send 938 Missions Podcast, a ministry of Baptist Men Missions designed to encourage, equip, and inspire the next generation of missionary servants and the churches who will send them. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, Administrator for North American, Asian, and South Pacific Ministries, as well as one of the instructors in this year's summer revitalization course taking place here at the Global Ministry Center, June 4th, 5th, and 6th. If you're a pastor or a student preparing for ministry, we would love to see you in this class. It's being put on here, as I said, in Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Jason Ormiston, who is pastoring up in Minneapolis and is serving as our director for church planting and development, will be here with me, along with a few guests that we're bringing in. Larry Hobbs from Arch Ministries, Michael Carlisle, who's one of our missionaries previously from Cambodia, going to be doing some work with us in multicultural engagement, and a guest that I have mentioned in the last few weeks of our episode as a yet unannounced instructor is actually joining me today for today's discussion on rural revitalization, and that is Dennis Wilkening. Dennis, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you come be a part of what we're doing here in June, and eager to have this conversation with you today, because as we have, in the few times that we have interacted over the last 12, 15 months, when I've been on campus out there in Ankeny or been in a local church that you've been in, I have noted just in talking with you that, man, we've been running some parallel tracks in terms of ministry dynamics and opportunities, and it's so exciting to talk to another guy who stood in a rural environment in a backwater kind of community, proverbially speaking there, obviously, but did the hard work of seeing a church brought back to thriving existence and identity in the community. And so eager to talk with you a little bit about this today, but especially glad to have you part of the team this summer for our revitalization track.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
So right now you are serving on the faculty at Faith Baptist Bible College there in Ankeny, Iowa, my alma mater three times over. Go Eagles.
Go Eagles.
And you're doing that in the capacity as the chair or the department head for the counseling department, successfully, as we talked about before, leading a team of one.
Right. My whole department.
Which, hey, if you're a rural church pastor, that's probably right, you know, up your alley, right? That's the MO. But before that, you spent 12 years pastoring a church in Colville, Washington. And so that's primarily the experience that I want to interact with you about, but 22 years of pastoral ministry behind you now, and helping train next generation of church leaders, pastors, and counselors. So grateful for what you're doing there.
I love rural church ministry. It was my favorite. I mean, other than working as an assistant pastor, I have a favorite pastor that I work for that I really love the team atmosphere. But as far as the phase of ministry, I loved rural church ministry. It was my favorite. And we saw the Lord do some amazing things. I'm just so grateful.
Yeah, because you went from Houston to Washington, right? So Houston is a mega city in terms of American standards.
Yes.
Maybe not global standards, but this mega city to a rural community in Washington state. What was the size of Colville?
We were just under 5,000 total population, county seat.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, you know, we're not making comparisons or anything here, but I wasn't in the county seat. I had a community of 1,200, so rural. Well, you got rural, and then you got real rural.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We were located just 50 miles south of Canada and just 50 miles west of Idaho.
Great,
beautiful mountain town on the way to nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like we had missionaries and things stopping through. If they weren't intentional about being in Colville, you probably weren't there.
Yeah, yeah.
But we did have the only Walmart for 110 miles. So from the border of Canada all the way to Spokane, Washington, we had the only Walmart. So, right.
So Colville, if you were at First Baptist Colville, and I said Colville a minute ago, cause I'm looking at you on Zoom and I'm reading the sign you have on the back on the Colville trading company.
Yeah,
it's throwing my pronunciation off.
So. It looks like Colville, but it said like the phone Colville. That's how we knew we had guests.
It's my first time in Colville. Yeah. So you said a minute ago it was your favorite ministry. You love rural ministry.
Yeah.
I believe when I was in seminary, I said to some friends and family, I think I'm better suited for rural ministry than I am urban ministry. Mm-hmm. I had no context for making that assessment. I just believed it would be true. I enjoyed things that people in rural environments, you know, do. Hunting, being outdoors, tearing apart your own trucks and tractors and rebuilding things. Those were the things I enjoyed. That was the thing that kind of drew me to that mindset about doing ministry in a rural agrarian society. What was it that you really enjoyed about the dynamics of rural life and ministry?
Well, I enjoy many of those same things. You know, I'm a fly fisherman, and so being able to do one of my favorite things was that. My wife and I, we enjoyed riding the motorcycle, and we had one of the top 10 rides in the whole state within 30 minutes of our house. And so And we got to ride up and over the Cascades and different things out west. But when I was a college student, I was impressed. There was a pastor who came through our preacher boys class and said, if you really want to make a difference for the Lord, why don't you consider going west of the Mississippi? And when we graduated, my wife and I got to travel and recruit for the college we graduated from. And we spent quite a bit of time out in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. And we had said, you know, if the Lord ever opened the door to bring us back to do ministry in the West, we would love to do it. And it just seemed like he never did. Never, that opportunity was never open until we were on staff there in Houston, Texas. And we had been there for 6 or 8 years. And the Lord started impressing upon my heart the idea of being a senior pastor. So what we did was we limited our search, in essence, west of the Mississippi. To begin with, we thought, let's go close to home. And so we did try that. The Lord closed those doors. And I said, I think this is the Lord letting us go west. And so that's how the Lord put us in Colville together.
Yeah. My experience in rural ministry was that there were not the same barriers to overcome in ministry that a lot of my friends who had a more urban, suburban experience had. People were welcoming. They were friendly. Doors were opened, opportunities to serve in the community were abundant. So let's talk a little bit about the revitalization effort. When you arrived in Colville, was this a church that you walked into saying, this is a place that needs a breath of new life? There's some necessary renewal here. Or was this a church that was kind of on autopilot and then somehow you guys found high gear before you were done?
Sure. Well, I think a little bit of both. Maybe every church is. Yeah. When we got there, we were following a season of 18 months without a pastor.
Okay.
So they had an intentional interim pastor who did fantastic. He didn't change anything. He had them stay exactly as they were. He just preached for them and he helped them maybe navigate some of their deacons meetings when there were disagreements, but he was what you would want. As a pastor coming in, this older gentleman was exactly what you would want to follow.
Before we move on, that's worth just highlighting because we've got a lot of young guys preparing for ministry. And an interim pastor has the responsibility of preserving a ministry, not trying to change everything. I had a few friends who found themselves in pastorates where an interim had been there and had, you know, hey, let's do some constitutional work and let's make some dynamic changes to leadership positions and structure and let's get this thing situated right. And it creates a firestorm for the next guy to step into. So that's just worth highlighting that you had that experience because that's really noteworthy. So
this church was actually trying to decide before their pastor left, previous pastor had left, they were trying to decide whether to continue to be congregational rule or be elder led. And the interim pastor was like, we are what the Constitution says we are until you get your next pastor. How grateful was I? You know, so I was like, oh, I don't have to fight this. And it was, super grateful.
That's good. Yeah. So stepping into that role then, were you able to just come in and say, okay, I'm here now. What are the initiatives that we need to undertake? What are the priorities we need to recognize? What was the first step for you?
We backed it. I would back it up even farther than that. We took before we agreed to come candidate, we took a survey trip. And the church flew us out and we stayed there for 5 days, 6 days. And I walked Main Street, knocked on, you know, went to businesses and said, what do you know about First Baptist Church? And who do you know goes there? And where's it located? You know, we're a small town, so you should know where the Baptist Church is. And I didn't have anybody know where it was at. And we were right across from the junior high school. There were two churches. One sat on one corner and we sat on another. And I walked through the church just to kind of get, you know, how that as a guest would the first time you're seeing something. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any material to invite someone to come and be a part of our church. Really no tracks and I'm not even saying track like a chick track. I'm just talking about a card that says this, you know, this is where you know, these are our meeting times and we'd like to invite you to be a guest. There wasn't even one of those.
Yeah.
No, there wasn't evangelism taking place. So when we sat in the deacon's meeting, or not really a deacon's meeting, it wasn't even candidating. It was the pre-candidation meeting. And I asked, you know, when's the last time you had a baptism? And it'd been a couple years.
Dennis, I am telling you, we haven't had this conversation, but you are describing exactly my experience in Fowler, like to a T. Flew out for a week ahead of time, spent time in the community, walked the church with eyes like a visitor, a guest. What would they think? How would they respond? Asked the question about when the last salvation was. Nobody there, apart from a child in the church who had been raised in the church, nobody could remember when the last person was saved and brought into membership. Mm-hmm. Was the baptismal used for like Christmas decoration storage? Was that?
It wasn't that bad. Oh, okay. We didn't have a baptismal.
Well, that's maybe arguably worse.
It was a Baptist church without a baptismal. Actually, that's unfair. Out in the barn, there is a portable one that we would bring in and set up for baptisms. And we did that for years until we did our, you know, after I got there, until we did our remodel and put a baptistry in the sanctuary as because we would be used.
So just to jump forward here, and we'll come back, but just to jump forward, in the end of your time there in Colville, what was the dynamic of the ministry from what you're describing having visited during your pre-candidature visit to when you left and departed? What was the dynamic and profile of the church like?
Well, I mean, more than half were first generation Christians that we had won through our ministry. I don't have my stats with me. I used to memorize this stuff. I'm not sure it really even matters, but
yeah, no, it doesn't.
You know, I think we baptized like 180 people in 11 years.
Wow.
And we had 130 something salvations that we know of, you know, that were tied directly to our ministry. I've forgotten some of the numbers. I wasn't a super, I knew my numbers when I was a pastor, but I wasn't a super big numbers guy. I thought that was only one metric,
mm-hmm.
but whenever you see someone walk the aisle and trust Christ as Savior and get baptized and start getting discipled, it changes what you expect in church. So I would say when I left, the church was expecting that something was going to happen Sunday morning. Mm. Someone was going to make a decision. Someone was going to get baptized. Someone was going to, the anticipation was there, where that probably was not the case when I first came. We weren't expecting, we were there because we were faithful, but we really weren't expecting the Lord to move. Now, and that may be an unfair characterization of a whole group of people when certain individuals may have been expecting that. But I would say as a whole, we weren't.
Yeah. Well, I think that's actually fairly representative of most churches in America today. You know, they've gotten in, as I said earlier, kind of gotten into that autopilot speed. They're comfortable with it. Everybody knows their role, knows where they're supposed to be, when they're supposed to be there. And not by maybe choice or philosophy defining expectations, but just by consequence of what we've experienced over the last two decades, this is kind of what we anticipate. And that's what's going to happen because that's what we anticipate what's going to happen.
That's true.
I had a fairly similar experience, you know, in our church and had a group of people who graciously, I was young, I was 25 when I took the pastorate in this church at Faith in Fowler, Colorado. I had a group of people who knew how to love their pastor when their pastor wasn't really sure how to shepherd them. I was grateful for that. But it was a group of people who had not seen, maybe for a decade or two, the effectual working of gospel ministry in their midst. They had confidence about the power of the gospel, but they didn't have the experience of seeing recently lives transformed. And the biggest driving factor, I think, in our revitalization at Faith was the kind of constant flow of new believers through the door. People got really excited about the fact that they were there, and they started putting away all of their little preconceived notions about what church is supposed to look like and feel like and sound like. And I'm not talking about like worship style and stuff. I'm talking about like, oh, this is a sacred moment. Nobody moves, you know, that it's okay. People moved and noises were made and people talked and, you know, that type of stuff. They just put away their sensitivities really excited about people being there.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, when we first came, we had one baby in the nursery.
Yeah, that ours was the baby in the nursery.
Yeah, and just within just a few years, I can remember, I think it was 4 years later, we had 18 babies in the nursery. So church got loud, you know, and it was exciting. You know, like I said, as a pastor, I was excited every Sunday. I'm like, yeah, today's Sunday. Let's go.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah. I had an older lady stand up at our Thanksgiving dinner about 4 years after we got there. And it was kind of a let's give some thanks and praise kind of moment after the meal. And she said, you know, 4 years ago when Pastor Anderson got here, we had no babies in the nursery. And Pastor Anderson arrived, and now we've got 7 babies in the nursery. And I stood up and I was like, just so everyone understands, none of those except for one are mine. I'm not the one who put all the babies in the nursery, but I'm glad to be here to be part of that.
I like it.
Yeah. So my experience would lead me to believe this statement, and I'm going to give it to you. And you just can you just respond to it and expound on it if you're able. I think you are. But really genuine renewal in the church in America takes place from the top down. It's not specifically congregation-led to the degree that you could, say, bring in somebody to train a congregation on revitalization, and apart from the pastor being an active participant, it's going to happen. So tell me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I agree completely. So I tell people all the time, it wasn't – a lot of times you think that in a revitalization work – that you're going to come in as the savior and you're going to transform it, right? And that's not revitalization. Revitalization just as much is the church and the pastor are both being revitalized. They're both anticipating things of the Lord. But I do believe the pastor brings the excitement and the credibility of what God is doing and could do through that local church. And then the church catches that vision that he continues to paint about God working and changing lives. And they also begin to believe that that's how God still works today. And they begin to expect that. And so I was very fortunate to work with a group of believers there at First Baptist in Colville, that group that just kind of held everything together for years. And their heart was, we want to see God move. I could tell when I met with the deacons, we want that for our church. So it wasn't, there was this resistance that said, nope.
Yeah.
We don't want to see God work. I think sometimes we hold on to things that maybe are hurdles for God to work, but those are easy enough to teach through. I could not have seen, I don't think we would have seen the Lord work in the way it did if I was the only one who was excited about what the Lord could do. It took the entire congregation, and they were such beautiful people who love the Lord deeply.
Yeah, it takes the shepherd being the example to the flock that I think we're expected to be. So for me, and you tell me about your own experiences here, but for me, it was being an active participant in the life of the community in purposefully visible ways. I wanted people in the community, because I had the same experience, not during the survey trip, but after I got there, visiting with folks regularly. What do you know about our church? And I heard some of the most unbelievable stories about things that the church had done in the past that just left you like scratching your head. Like, come on, guys, what were we thinking? And I'm not saying that to criticize any of my predecessors or any, you know, I've made some really foolish mistakes too. And someday someone's going to point them out. Hopefully not on a podcast, but you know, that's what it is. But, I sought out ways to be visible and engaged in the community. So, you know, I joined the fire department. I coached little league, basketball and then soccer for my kids when they got old enough to be in club league sports there in town. Participated in the local livestock sale barn, started raising some livestock of our own on our little property that we bought. In town. And I think those were things that said to the community and the church both, oh, this guy's actually building a life here. He's here to stay. And through those avenues, I had opportunities for personal evangelism where I was able as the pastor to introduce new believers to the church family. It wasn't that so-and-so invited their neighbor. I mean, this was happening, but it wasn't just people in the church were inviting their neighbors, their friends, their family, to be participants in the ministry of our church. It wasn't that they were doing, you know, Bible studies on their own, which many of them did grow to do. It was that I was able to say, you know, just the other week, here's the conversation I was having, and this is the product of it. This is the thing that really, and those types of just the other day type of examples are really poignant in small church life.
I can agree wholeheartedly with that. You know, we loved our community. And so we joined the Chamber of Commerce for our local community. And when they had work days to clean up a park, or we had a little square downtown and it was called Heritage Court, and they were looking for people to come and do that. And my wife and I, my kids, some of my church members, some of the youth group, we all went out and helped clean that up. And here's a church that's not only, they're not just looking out for themselves. They're part of our community. They, you know, they care about us. And that's not always the case. Sometimes we as pastors care about what's happening at our church, but not so much what's happening outside of it. Yeah. But I think especially for rural church ministry, if you're not a friend to that community, it's going to be difficult to reach your community with the gospel.
Yeah, this is a distinction. I'm sitting here listening to you talk about cleaning up the park and that, and I'm thinking to myself, how is this different from an urban church going down and, say, cleaning up the trash at the local playground or whatever? I mean, we're not talking about something that is distinct or unique to rural ministry. We're talking about, when we talk about this in a rural context, we're talking about the way that the community perceives what we're doing. If you go to, in a town of 3,000, you go down and clean up all the leaves in the park in the fall, or you go down and you do an ice cream social for the community on a summer evening or something like that, everybody in town, everybody within 10 miles of town knows about what First Baptist did.
Yes.
If you do that in, you know, North Houston, there's a few hundred people who may have driven by, who saw something going on, but had no idea who was responsible for it. And the difference then is the message that it sends to the community about the place, the presence of the church in the community. One of the things that I highlight during our revitalization training is the fact that it is important for churches to demonstrate to the community that there is still life in that body. There's something that's still happening here. And we are not, at the older we get, drawing further away from the community. We're looking for new ways to engage the community around us.
which means if your community changes, you may have to change a few of the ways that you reach. We did some things that were unique to our area outreaches that wouldn't work anywhere else. But when I was in Houston, we just kind of put a pin in the map and drew a 5-mile radius circle and said, this is our impact zone. This is where we want to spend most of our time and resources within 5 miles of our church. But in Houston, 5 miles could be 200,000 people.
Right.
It's just, you know, but you, because you're such a big area, you might have to say, I can't reach a whole zip code.
Well, and Houston, you've got some of the biggest churches in the country right down the road from you. You know, these big magnets.
We have 8 million people. So if you had a 10,000 member church, you have a drop in the bucket of what's actually there. So the idea that we wouldn't be able to fill a church because there's large churches there, I think isn't real accurate. I mean, we had, our church bought a church from the Southern Baptist who went up the road and built for a 5 or 6,000 member church. And we weren't wanting for people who weren't going to church.
Yeah.
I mean, there's still a ton out there. You just got to go find them.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think it's a matter of, you know, I say that not to say it's a matter of you can't do this, you can't do that there. It's that when there's a lot of churches in the area, people tend to do a lot of comparison shopping.
And that becomes
a bit of a challenge, especially for the small church, the struggling church that's looking for their footing again. So that kind of is an added dynamic. Getting back to the long-term presence, you know, the pastor laying down roots in the community, I think that's important. But, you know, one of the reasons that at BMM we're doing this revitalization training, we're training pastors and guys who are preparing for pastoral ministry in the philosophy and basics of revitalization work is because I think the best chance of a church actually being revitalized rather than just reformed, and I don't mean that in a theological sense, just momentarily reformed, takes place when a guy says, I'm going to be a part of renewing the life of this church, and I'm not going to leave when I'm done. I think churches, this is somewhat anecdotal, but I think churches respond better when they know that the work that's being done is being done by someone who's planning to be here for the rest of their life if the Lord would allow.
Yeah.
And it's something that people can get behind because they're not tempted to think, well, as soon as he's gone, this is all going to fall apart. This will be, the next guy won't care about these things.
Yeah.
And so there are groups out there that are recruiting revitalization specialists to go in and help churches that are without a pastor that are looking for help. We get calls from churches that are without pastors that are looking for help. There are groups that are doing that. We're more focused on the churches that have pastors who are needing to understand the dynamics of renewed life in ministry today, but don't want to leave to find it. They would love to see it done there.
Well, you certainly can't give to someone something that you don't have yourself. You know, I think of a passion for souls.
Yeah.
You know, because when I went to Colville, I did in my candidation interview, they asked, what type of pastor are you? And I said, I'm a soul winning pastor. You know, I want to see people get saved. I want to see lives changed. But I will say not every. So I told them, I know that not every church is looking for that. I know it sounds weird that you would say that, but I know that every church is not looking for that because that makes us get out of our comfort zone. So, and I just asked them, if you're not looking for that, rather than us fighting against each other for the next 10, 11, 12, 15 years, why don't you just call somebody who wants to do what you want to do? Because I want to win people to the Lord. And if that's not where we're going as a church, we just want to be us, but a better version of us.
Yeah.
With a full-time pastor, then I would prefer that you just let me go to a church who wants to see their community change. And they were like, hey, this is what we've been praying for. Right. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take you at your word.
So on the spectrum of what people, and obviously this is an entirely subjective designation, on the spectrum of what people might assume would be traditional to modern in the dynamics, methodologies, worship of the church, what would First Baptist Colville look like on that spectrum?
We were traditional. So now I will say about once I was in 3 years, I was a solo pastor for 3 years. Once we got our youth pastor in, I do like some of the modern hymns that the Gettys and some others sing. And so we started incorporating some of those, but we had no less than 3 hymns a Sunday. And then maybe we had 2 choruses or we split it 50-50 or however we did it. But I mean, I always told them what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We're all going to tie our roots back to the hymnal, and we're all going to learn good music that's being produced today as well. But we're going to do it happily as a church together. And we're going to sing with all of our heart unto the Lord. And you know what? We never lost anyone over music.
Yeah. I asked that question privately when I'm talking with guys who have been in churches that have seen renewed health in recent days. And overwhelmingly, the guys that are describing experiences like you and I have had, it's a more traditional blend of worship. I'm on repeat at this point, but same experience, you know, in our church, five songs, three hymns, two choruses. Yeah. And we never lost any. Well, I can't say that. No, I can't say that. We didn't lose anybody over music. In the end, that person proved to be troubled by choices in translation philosophy rather than music. But, you know, those things happen.
Well, I was purposeful. I didn't want to lose anyone. I wasn't one of those pastors who was like, oh, this is the Lord pruning his church. I really felt like could keep everyone. I wanted, because my older members, they're going to be my disciplers. They're the mature ones who are going to help us so much. And they tie us to our history. And I love them. So there was no way that I wanted to move so quickly that I was going to lose some of my greatest resources. They were just so solid.
Yeah. I've always personally recoiled at the phrasing of blessed subtraction from the church. I think it's an absolute misnomer. I too was aware of this truth. I think my dad had impressed this upon me pretty carefully. And that was that there was coming a day as a pastor when I would give an account for the way that I shepherded the souls of all of the people that God had given me. Yeah. And if my disdain for their preferences and priorities and misunderstandings left me unwilling and unconcerned to engage in shepherding their soul, I was going to be the one who gave account for that one day in a more significant fashion than they would probably give an account to the Lord for what I was distressed over. The idea that somebody who is of an age or generation that their interests in the church, their philosophy of ministry, their methodology, interests, whatever, is perceived to be kind of holding things back. The idea that they're a boat anchor and not a soul who's deserving of a pastor caring for them, that's a really foreign thought to me, but it is very, very prevalent in the church today. And
I think you stated that really well.
So the pastor who demonstrates a kind of shepherding interest in his people will tend to be the guy who they trust, right?
Absolutely.
So what does trust, building trust in a congregational population, what does that do to help lead necessary change in pursuit of renewal in the church?
Well, if you've built trust, they're certainly more willing to follow. And if they believe that you're going to stay, they're willing to change. But most of the, like you said, unnecessary change, I only wanted to change things that another pastor wouldn't have to come in by preference to change. Does that make sense? So I'm hoping no pastor would come in and say, we've got to stop reaching our community with the gospel, you know, or, you know, we've got to stop this. So I tried to only change certain things, and anything that was a preference, I always voice that very clearly and say, you know, this is just Dennis. This is just the way I like to do things. If someone was to come in and do them differently, it wouldn't matter to the dynamics or the DNA of our church. So if I was going to spend capital, if I was going to spend trust, it was going to be on something doctrinal or something, that the church needed to have baked in its DNA to be a good local New Testament church.
Yeah. Rewriting that DNA is important. Some of that does happen when new leadership is developed within the church. So, you know, guy or gal gets saved. They're discipled into a growing, maturing faith. They're given opportunities to serve, and in those service capacities in the church, and maybe it's children's ministry, maybe it's hospitality ministries, maybe it's serving in the music ministry. There's a fresh face. There's a new mindset about it. There are new ideas to be exchanged. A lot of change doesn't happen because the pastor says, I want this to change, and now it's going to change. That's really foolish leadership practice. But a good shepherd can recognize those who are being developed in leadership and service roles in the church who could be helpful in affecting the kind of change that you see necessary. And so, you know, a good leader is going to build trust with people so that when they say, you know, you've been doing children's Sunday school for 22 years now, and we're so grateful for you. We want to honor you. We want to acknowledge that. But I also think it's really important for you to have an opportunity to be in Sunday morning worship, maybe 6 months out of the year, because you're not in children's church. Are you okay with me putting somebody in your classroom for the next 3 months to learn how you do this, and then giving some time away from the classroom for them to step into a service role? Yeah, that's great, Pastor. I would be really happy for the help, and I'd love to see, you know, whoever it is, be a help in this way. And then all of a sudden, you've got a totally different dynamic in your children's ministry that allows you to just say, now the tone can be changed a little. We can do some things differently than we did before, and it doesn't upset anybody. It's an exercise in careful leadership.
Yeah, well, I think that if we're going to be good leaders, we have to be good teachers. So we need to teach why these things are important. And everyone, I mean, shouldn't we have people being trained consistently? We did that with our deacons. The first year you became a deacon, it was a trial year. You could say, I don't want to serve. And the church could say, they don't want you to serve, right, after a year. And then you commit to a 3-year and then roll off so that we don't have a power concentration. But that allowed us to bring in some guys and say, hey, we would like to train you up in leadership. And so we would have them serve in that capacity. And it became a discussion among our deacons every year, who in our church could benefit from training, from seeing how things are done, from serving in this, because they're faithful. They're coming to church services. They may be even teaching a Sunday school class, but how can we further that? And yeah. I also think that engenders trust. Here, pastor he's looking and saying, for the future of our church and for the good of our church body, and we need more people serving, not just the same individuals who've always done it.
Yeah. And those dynamics, it's critical to understand that interpersonal dynamics in small churches, especially, are often the thing that are just dragging the brake on forward progress. And so remedying that through transitions in service ministries, and you connected two important ideas here that I think an entire generation of pastors who are being prepared for ministry, who have been prepared for ministry over the last decade, 20 years or so, I think an important concept that you touched on, maybe purposefully, is often overlooked, is the direct connection between service and leadership. When you were talking about your deacons, you kind of used those terms interchangeably, that we wanted to develop leaders and give them opportunities to serve. And this generation that kind of recoils at the idea that deacons would have a voice in directing care in the church— are missing the idea that people who serve really well tend to be the ones that the church also looks to for help in direction and decision-making. And yeah. I think it was Doug Brown. Nope, it wasn't. It was Dan Brown in one of the courses that I took in seminary from him, who said the best definition of a deacon is simply the person, the qualified man who is doing precisely what the church as a congregation has asked them to do. And in some churches, they serve through financial management, buildings and grounds type of stuff, trustee work in other named environments. Sometimes it is through serving as wise counsel to the pastor, elder, bishop, or pastors, if there's a multiplicity of them in the staff. It's whatever the church has said, here's what we want our deacons to do for us. They're the servants of this body. Here's what we'd like them to do. And people just miss that direct connection. If you're going to serve well, you're going to end up leading people.
Well, and I don't know how other pastors feel, but I felt like I got to serve with some spiritual giants in Colville. There were times when, as even as a pastor, I said, the characteristic that man just displayed inside of this meeting or at a service or whatever, I want to emulate that. You know, even as a pastor, I would see some of these spiritual characteristics in the deacons and just say, wow, I'm in awe. I need to learn that for myself. That was good.
I did two funerals for guys who served as deacons during my pastorate who had served as deacons at various times over most of their experience in the church. One had been there for 50 plus years. The other had been there for 40 plus years. And I distinctly recall purposefully saying at their funerals, this church exists as it does today because 25, 30, 40 years ago, these men served in ways in this church that helped keep it upright and on the rails.
Amen.
And there were some tragic experiences in pastoral leadership and transition in the history of our church. And I wasn't just theoretically saying that. I was saying from stated history, the things that those guys had done to preserve that church family were beyond commendable. And they weren't pastors. They never led a congregation as a pastor a day in their life. But they served faithfully as leaders in the church because they served well. And that Amen. Was a consequence of their good service. So leadership is important in renewed ministry. Commitment and investment in the church and community are important as aspects of renewed life in a congregation. Careful evangelism is a necessary element. These are actually all things. You're not leading the entire week of classes, but all of these things are things that we talk through in our revitalization class. But one more thing that we spend some time on, and this is one of the areas you're going to be dealing with this summer for us, is closing the back door on ministry. So it's really important that churches get the idea that somebody walking through the front door isn't a guest, they're a visitor.
Other way around.
it's important they understand they're not a visitor, they're a guest. Yes. A visitor is somebody who shows up and interrupts, but you host them because they're there. A guest is somebody you anticipate, prepare for, and Amen. Welcome. Anyhow, it's really important that they understand that dynamic because you want somebody to walk in feel at home, not because that you have made the church so comfortable for the unbelieving world that they don't know the difference, but welcomed in the sense that nobody is standing there looking at them sideways, wondering where they came from, why they're dressed the way they are, and what in the world they're doing there.
Absolutely.
So if you accomplish that, and we're going to assume the church has figured out how to do that, how do you keep the back door closed so that 3 months later you're not left wondering, where did that family go? They were here for like 6 weeks and then they're gone. What happened?
We called it an assimilation process. We actually had steps already laid out. So we knew when a guest walked through the door, when they said, well, what's next for me? When that first question came to me, I think I was a year in, they're like, Pastor, we really like this church. What's next? And I looked around and went, you just attend on Sunday morning, I guess. So I was like, hey, we should talk to the pastor about that. Then I realized I was the pastor. I probably should have a plan for that. So I just determined we're going to set up a way that we can push this through. So the first step for us was called a first steps class, because I thought that was fitting. What's the next thing? And it really was a membership class. Mm-hmm. It was one of the best things, because from that we found out, questions that we want to answer in our materials, before they even come to our church. So I use that as kind of a data gathering too, but we got to communicate, this is who we are. We didn't hide it. We are a Baptist church. This is what we believe. And we got a chance to answer questions in an informal setting. And then we told them the steps of what it is like to become a member, and then what our responsibility is as a church to them, and then what their responsibility as a member is to the local church. And that started painting a real clear picture of who we were as a church and whether they wanted to belong, and how serious that we took reaching our community with the gospel. And so for us, that membership class was the starting point of something wonderful for closing the back door. There were other things happening, but, and then we just told them, we're in a small town. So people came from a lot of different churches. You're joining us. We're not joining you. I know this may have been how other churches do it. This is how we do it. This is what we believe. And we think that the Lord would have everyone belong to a local church body. And so that started for us. That was the start of closing the back door.
Great.
And as the more people we had join and the more people we had start serving, that was helpful. So I read a book called Surprising Insights from the Unchurched by Tom Rainer.
Great book.
And one of the statistics out of there is, I think they did a study after 5 years or after 8 years. I can't remember. I'm going to misquote, but the number one deciding factor, whether someone was still in church in your church after 5 years or 8 years or whatever that statistic was whether they had a ministry. So directly from that, then we pointed them towards service. And we had some ministries you had to be a member, and other ministries where you did not, you had to be a faithful, regular attender of at least 6 months. And then once a year we did a ministry fair, and we had, our goal was at that service that 100% of our church and regular attenders got involved in a ministry. It could be small. I had one guy who all he did was fill the rock salt once a month for our water softener. But he was part of the men's ministry. That was his job. He did it faithfully. And it made him feel connected. But by connecting people to serving, now this isn't your church. It's not even the church that they attend. This is their church.
Yeah.
They serve here. They have ownership.
Yeah.
And what a world of difference we saw in the attitude of church membership.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so good. That's almost, again, I'm on repeat here. It's almost precisely what we were doing. We added some things to that. That when people would join the church, they would get like a, for a couple of years, we did this kind of like a swag bag.
Yeah.
So here's your t-shirt and hat you can wear with the church logo on it. Here's a little window sticker for your car that says, I heart my church, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's just like, it's just little ways. And I know that didn't grow the church and that didn't close the back door on everybody, but it gave people that, like that Sunday, they walked away going, I've got things to demonstrate to my neighbors, friends, and family that actually I do love my church. This is an awesome place, and I'm so glad I found it. So one of the things I want to back up on, you talked about the membership class, the first steps class. How long was yours?
So we did 3 hours one Saturday morning, once a quarter. That's how we started. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until several years, I want to say 8, maybe 9 years in, that we made it a part of the Sunday school. But we actually carved out a Saturday and just said from 9 to noon on this Saturday, come and we're going to do our first steps class. We incorporated it after the last couple of years before coming to faith here. We incorporated that as a Sunday school class.
So I would often offer it, especially if I had people in the church who were saying, hey, I'd like to talk to you about membership. I'm wondering about membership. What's this look like? Once I knew I had one or two people that were asking me about that, I would go several weeks in a row where I'd make an announcement about an upcoming membership class. And we were looking for willing participants. We were willing to work with their schedules to make it available when it was easy for them to participate. And inevitably, we would have one or two more that would go, oh, you're doing a class? I'll do that. And depending on who signed up, that was always what dictated how long the class was for me. Because I saw it as a way to kind of early disciple people into understanding responsibilities in the church. So if it was somebody who was coming from a well-churched, like, ooh, that's a great church, but like a well-churched background, like they grew up in church or they'd been part of a Baptist church, especially in the past, and kind of knew how things operate, that would be a few weeks and meet for an hour, hour and a half at a time for a few weeks, and we'd be done. If it was a brand new believer, I'd say, hey, let's do this on Friday nights. Why don't you come over to our house? And we'll kind of walk through a very light doctrine survey. It's almost, I found it after the fact. I'm sure it was published at the time. I just didn't know about it. It was John MacArthur's Foundations of the Faith Bible study. It was a very similar, not as intensive as that, but it was a very similar kind of walk through. Here are the basic things we believe. And then at the end of each week was, here's how this affects our church life. So it's a membership class. You want to learn about membership. So here's what we believe about God. This is how it affects our church life. And we'd go through it like that. And I found it to be a very helpful way in grounding people in the doctrines of the church, because it's not just, I wholeheartedly agree with you about the ownership aspect of ministry. I want someone to own their place in the church. This is my church, not the church I attend. But for that to happen, I really think it's critical that they come to a place of understanding and appreciating what the church believes and teaches. And I'm sure you do as well.
Oh yeah.
And to do that, if you get them kind of on board with what is believed and taught, then it makes it really hard for them to go anywhere else and find something different that they can get as excited about. And so I saw that as an opportunity for doctrinal engagement, for membership, discipleship, and for developing that kind of ownership mentality. This is actually what I believe, because I see it in scripture. I believe it. The church teaches it. This is where I should be, kind of line of thinking.
Right on. Yeah. I like it.
So Dennis, if you've got a young man in your ministry context, and I'm sure you do there at Faith, who's preparing for pastoral ministry, you know the statistics probably as well as anyone else, 70 to 90%, depending on the survey you read, of evangelical churches in America are plateaued or dying. They're struggling. Pretty good chance that young guy preparing for ministry is going to find himself in the pastorate in one of those churches in the next few years. What would your simple advice to that guy be in preparation for entering ministry in an environment that is grasping for life?
Well, you know, I always go back to the basics. I would say just win souls. It is amazing how that changes how you sit in church as a pastor, as you preach, and how your church feels. When something's healthy, it grows. When you have new life being born, it's amazing some of the heartache too that takes away. So if something's not going well, maybe there's someone who's disgruntled and you win someone to the Lord, it's amazing how it pales in comparison to that eternal glory that you're like, man, they got saved, and it totally changed your attitude. I just really think that most of our churches have plateaued because we've stopped winning souls and stopped discipling. I got accused. I wrote it down one time. I got accused of acting like a church plant, even though we already had 270 people at the time. Why are you still doing that? You're acting like you're a church plant. I was like, that's because when you're a church plant, you have to do all these things to survive.
Yeah.
You have to win souls because nobody's there. You have to knock on doors. You have to, you know, care for everyone inside your church. And I said, I'm not sure that that's just for church plants. I'm pretty sure that's just pastoring. That's what that is. And so I love that about ministry. And the only reason I'm at a Bible college now and not at my church in Colville is because I wanted to give young people the same passion for winning souls, discipling people and seeing lives changed. But I wanted to do that before they graduate. I just said, I want you to love the local church.
Yeah.
I want you to love people. I want you to love your Savior more. So that's how I ended up at Faith.
That's great. It's good advice. A church being renewed is a church that's acting like a church plant. Simple.
Amen.
Yeah. Yep. Dennis, appreciate you so much for the wisdom that you've shared here today. Grateful for it. It's been a challenge and encouragement to my own heart. I am sure that our listening audience feels the same. If you'd like to share with us a comment, question, or response to something you heard today or any other episode, you can send us an email at send938@bmm.org. And as always, no matter what streaming platform you're listening on today, make sure to leave us a 5-star rating and review to help others find this, the Send 938 Missions Podcast. And we'll meet you back here next Wednesday.